From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. A complete tally of casualties from Hurricane Katrina is probably months away, but for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, the process of reckoning has already begun. In part, that's because after the September 11th terrorist attacks, the New York Times unwittingly created a new model for remembering those lost in a disaster by quickly publishing what it called Portraits of Grief, biographical sketches shorter than an obituary, but containing at least one anecdote supplied by the victim's family or close friends. Ultimately, the series presented more than 1,800 portraits. For many readers, it was the way to comprehend some of the individual losses incurred by nearly 3,000 dead. Certainly, the New York Times series posed many challenges to the reporters assigned to it, but the New Orleans Times-Picayune series that launches next week will likely be even tougher to write. Jim Amos is the editor of the Times Picayune. He joins us from his temporary offices in Baton Rouge. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Why did you choose to go the Portraits of Grief route? What did you want to do with this form that you didn't think you could do any other way?
Well, I think you want to explode whatever it is behind this number of casualties that keeps being bandied about, you know, whether it's 1,000 or more. I mean, it becomes sort of a numbing statistic. And this is a project that will last over months, I presume, and it will constantly remind people, remind readers of the culture and the lives behind the statistic.
So what sort of resources will you be devoting to the series?
The best way to approach it, we felt, was to concentrate heavily at the very outset on finding people in a difficult situation and relying after that on readers by word of mouth. Our online version of the newspaper, we get in excess of 30 million hits a day, and we think that that means that a lot of people will either see or hear of what we're doing.
Where else do you expect to get information?
We've contacted some of the central points. For example, there's a morgue in St. Gabriel, Louisiana, which is near Baton Rouge and is the main place to which bodies of Katrina victims were brought, and that morgue released for the first time the names of 32 victims, so that's a start.
Perhaps an even tougher job will be finding those people who knew them.
Also, finding people who knew them well enough that they can really give us some important information about their lives. You know, finding distant cousins probably won't be enough. And in contrast to the New York example, it won't be as easy to pinpoint the very next of kin just because everybody is so scattered.
You've just barely begun this project. Have you already run into problems?
One of the problems that we're running into is how to categorize people. Our first line of inquiry is going to be to find obvious victims of the storm, people, for example, who drown. But what do you do with people who died in subsequent days or weeks? For example, this week, a famous chef from New Orleans, Austin Leslie, who was well known as a chef in an African-American neighborhood and restaurant, died of a heart attack. And I think there are probably some fairly good reasons to believe that he would not have died had it not been for the storm and the grief that followed the storm. So that's one of our challenges, how to deal with these kinds of cases.
Another one would be, I guess, the New Orleans Times-Picayune is not really just focusing on New Orleans.
Clearly, the Gulf Coast and now, as a result of Rita, the parts of southwest Louisiana were deeply affected and people died there as well. I mean, I think our scope will extend to both those areas.
I'm just wondering whether race or class will be part of these portraits. It seems, because of the political fallout from Katrina, that your portraits of grief could fuel a larger discussion about poverty and race.
Well, you know, that relies on the presumption that the victims will emerge as overwhelmingly of one ethnic group or another. And I don't think that will necessarily be the case, although the reporting, at least in the national press, has tended to indicate that. Yes, it's true that resourceful people, by and large, had the means to flee the hurricane and did so in greater numbers than poor people did. And so to that extent, maybe it's unbalanced. But there were many people of means who chose to stick it out and to their peril.
You know, New York Times reporters who worked on the Portraits of Grief have described how, frankly, painful it was to mine these personal stories from grieving families. In fact, because the emotional toll was so great, the labor was widely divided among the very large New York Times staff. And these reporters weren't even left homeless or exiled, like so many of your reporters have been. Have you considered the toll it might take?
You know, I've considered the toll that everything we've done has taken. I think this is one of the most painful tasks that any reporter can undertake. But I think also at the same time, it has a cathartic effect to be doing something that people will be so grateful to have.
Do you even have a guess as to how many you'll ultimately print?
I would like to cover every possible one we can get. I think I'll only be satisfied if we approach that goal. You know, that has to be the goal.
Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jim Amos is the editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune.
If you happen to be a regular viewer of Al Jazeera, you know the name and face of Kaiser Alooney. He was the network's correspondent on the ground in Afghanistan during the U.S. war against the Taliban. A year later, he moved to Baghdad to cover the invasion of Iraq. He often appeared on Al Jazeera as an analyst on the subject of Islamist terror groups. But Alooney's biggest claim to fame was his exclusive interview with Osama bin Laden shortly after the 9/11 attacks. Biggest, that is, until this week, when he was convicted by a Spanish judge of collaborating with Al-Qaeda and sentenced to 7 years in prison. According to the verdict, Alooney used his job in journalism as a cover for activities like passing money and messages between Al-Qaeda associates. James Badcock covered the trial for the English edition of the Spanish daily El País. He says much of the prosecution rested on circumstantial evidence about Alooney's ties to Islamist extremists in the 90s when he was working as a translator in Spain.
Telephone conversations, meetings, dinners, favors. He helped individuals. He would give them his house to stay in, or he helped people with their paperwork as they're immigrants, you know, from Arab countries, mostly from Syria in this case.
Some of the most damning evidence, I gather, occurred after he moved to Afghanistan to report there for Al Jazeera.
That's right. He moved to Afghanistan in 2000. The judge believed that he was encouraged to do so by Mustafa Setmarian, a fellow Syrian he had met in Spain. Setmarian was, by all accounts and by Alooney's own admission, working there in a terrorist training camp. And it's through Setmarian that Alooney was able to interview bin Laden. And in Afghanistan, Alooney received some money that was sent from the group's leader, Abu Dada, also convicted this week. He handed it to Mohammed Baia, who is commonly held to be a messenger for Al-Qaeda.
Now, the money exchange. Alooney said that it was very innocent. How could it have been that?
Alooney doesn't claim to know what the money was for. He simply claims that he couldn't refuse, that these were people he knew and who trusted him. And the Muslim tradition of friendship and hospitality obliged him to go through with the act. Otherwise, they would be suspicious of him and he would be out of the loop. And he admits that it was in his interest to carry out this favor because he was getting information from these guys.
The International Federation of Journalists criticized the verdict and said that it could lead to self-censorship by journalists throughout the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And the editor-in-chief of Al Jazeera, Ahmad Sheikh, echoed the sentiment. He said, from the moment the world was divided into two camps, an axis of evil and an axis of good, our job became more complicated. Mm-hmm. As journalists, we have to talk to both camps.
I think there's an element of truth in that, for sure. All journalists know that, you know, the more phone conversations, the more meetings you have with people, then the closer you're going to get to the truth of that particular community. But the amount of personal contact Alooney has had with these men for many years, long before he was actually an independent journalist, these contacts weren't really something he was using in his daily work. He hasn't really managed to explain why so many of his friends were involved in this terrorist ring.
James, there seem to be a number of possibilities here. One is that Alooney is guilty as charged. Another is that he was merely caught in a web of circumstantial evidence that could trap any legitimate, unbiased journalist Cultivating Sources in a major ongoing story involving lots of bad, bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And the third is that he isn't a terrorist, but a biased journalist with a lot of sympathy for a terrorist organization. What was your sense, having looked at the trial and looked at the evidence?
Well, there could be a strong argument for the third explanation. The judge seems to have accepted some of the grain of Aluni's defense, which was that as a journalist, it was in his interest to get to know members of an underground organization, such as this Al-Qaeda cell in Spain. The judge said in his summing up that journalistic truth, like all truth, doesn't come freely, and Aluni, and wanting to buy his slice of truth and his scoop, he overstepped the mark, that he actually found himself obliged to commit acts himself that broke the law and actually gave material help to this group of terrorists.
You know, there's this phenomenon that has been well observed over the years of beat reporters going native. And that's when, you know, the guys who cover the State Department find themselves wearing tweed sport coats with patches on the elbows and smoking pipes. And when police reporters start talking in, you know, radio codes, he's 10-6 on that one. Is this a cautionary tale about the dangers of going native?
Well, of course, it's natural for any investigative journalist to get as close as he can to his sources and to make those sources feel as comfortable as possible and not have to draw them out of their natural habitat, as it were. Obviously, in the future, any journalist in a similar situation is going to have to think hard about what environment he's getting himself into and whether he's prepared to pay the price.
All right, James. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
James Badcock is a freelance reporter based in Madrid. He covered the Tizer Aluni case for the Spanish daily El País.
Coming up, America's internet giants get tangled in Chinese rules and American ones, and how OTM was hoaxed, we admit it.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Judith Miller, the New York Times reporter convicted of civil contempt for refusing to identify a source, was released on Thursday after 85 days in the slammer. On Friday, she testified before a grand jury investigating who leaked the name of CIA operative Valerie Plame. Other reporters had made deals with the prosecutor or received explicit permission from their sources to testify. Miller said she would not make deals and was unpersuaded by the blanket waivers signed by government officials releasing her from her obligation to protect them. After testifying Friday, she explained that now she had the personal assurance she needed, a phone call from her source on the Plame case, known to be Louis Scooter Libby, the vice president's chief of staff, and that the prosecutor had promised her that her testimony would be limited to that source.
Believe me, I did not want to be in jail, but I would have stayed even longer if I had not achieved these two things, the personal waiver and the narrow testimony. I could not have testified without both of them.
Bill Keller, executive editor of the New York Times, released a statement Thursday saying, quote, "It's an enormous relief that Judy's ordeal is over. Her steadfastness in defense of principle has won her admiration from around the world, wherever people value a free, aggressive press." And he continued, "Her friends and colleagues are delighted she's free." Well, her friends, certainly, but not all of her colleagues. Here's why. Libby's lawyers told the Times that Miller had always had permission to testify. Nothing's changed. Yet it took 85 days in the cooler, with the looming threat of even more jail time, before she felt sufficiently reassured. She said the phone call did it. So why did it take so long to request that call? Her explanation is weak, one Times reporter told us. In fact, it's embarrassing. So Miller's hero's welcome is tinged with skepticism and concern. Skepticism that she was as steadfast as her paper claims, and concern that the affair sends the message not that the paragons of journalism will not be moved, but rather that reporters may well crumble after a few months in the big house. Many press defenders hope that the Miller affair will strengthen the case for a national shield law to protect anonymous sources, but as legal scholar Jeffrey Stone once told us, such laws are supposed to shield sources, not reporters. In the Plame case, the source is clearly a no-goodnik. He does not deserve journalism's protection. In fact, there's a possibility he'll drag journalism's best intentions down with him.
This week, Reporters Without Borders released a handbook for bloggers and cyber dissidents, chock full of advice for Internet users wishing to evade censors and maintain their independence amid government controls of online media. The handbook can be downloaded in several languages, including French, Arabic, and Farsi. It's also available in Mandarin, which is probably a good thing since measures passed this week by the Chinese government will make online communications within China even more difficult and fraught with peril than it already was. Here to speak with us about the new laws is Xiao Chang, the director of the Berkeley China Internet Project at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Xiao, welcome back to On the Media.
Thank you.
First of all, can you tell us what's actually outlawed or restricted by the new regulations that wasn't outlawed or restricted before?
There are two additional items that didn't happen before, which is A, do cannot use internet to advocate illegal organization activities. Another one is cannot use internet to organize demonstrations, assemblies, if it is illegal. These two new items are clearly focused on the capacity of organizing of the internet, which this power recently been demonstrated by the anti-Japanese protesters this spring. And the government certainly is fully aware of this potential.
That was a case where the government may have been sympathetic with the sentiment of the protests, but was terrified by how quickly they sprung up from nothing around the country.
That's right. The internet became a catalyst of those social activism, and that's what the Chinese government is really afraid of. Another aspect is the internet as an alternative media. No matter how much resources the government put it in to build up their propaganda sites, the internet users simply just bypass the government censor effort and the propaganda efforts. And that really worries the government.
And so one of the new provisions obliges individuals and groups to register as an official news organization before they're permitted to distribute any kind of news or commentary online. You talk about your chilling effect.
Yes, I mean, this is certainly has a chilling effect. Another thing government does is this what we call undercover online commentators. Government actually paying undercover agents to go into the online forums trying to steer the public opinion, but without revealing their own real identities. So there's an irony here. The government is using those agents without telling the netizens who they are and trying to sort of shape the online space. At the same time, the government forced all the websites, all the weblogs to be registered with a real identity, and therefore the internet police can hold them responsible to the individual behind those information.
For almost 40 years, the West has been trying to engage with China and to trade with the Chinese economy in hopes of bringing Chinese political values around to something more closely resembling democracy. What is the West supposed to do in reaction to this new law?
Coming to the West, it is a matter of fact that China is part of the globalization process. Internet is a big enabler for this process. When you are especially information technology company trying to expand your Chinese market, you have to be fully aware that this is also a country that just by sending email or expressing some decent opinions from the government, those individual internet users can be sentenced or imprisoned by the Chinese police.
Well, I'm glad you brought that subject up because earlier this month, Yahoo admitted that it had given the Chinese government information about the web use of a Chinese journalist, information that was used in convicting him of espionage. Now, Yahoo has said, and I think Google said something in a similar incident a year or so earlier, that it was simply a case of obeying local laws. But what about the problem of being a collaborator in political repression?
They were collaborating with the Chinese authority. In my view, they collaborated more than their legal obligations. Yahoo is probably the only international company who holds that much detail of the user's information, meaning if you want to have a Yahoo email account, you have to provide your address, your phone number, unlike using some other services. So Yahoo bears a specific responsibility for their users to protect their privacy. All these companies, whether Google or Yahoo, they are the pioneers of the information revolution. They all have a lovely mission statement in their charters. But coming to the situation in China, unless they make a serious effort, they're not going to get away from the image of collaborating with the Chinese internet police, and the consequences is devastating for those political prisoners in China.
All right. Well, Zhao, as always, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Zhao Shang directs the Berkeley China Internet Project at the University of California, Berkeley, Graduate School of Journalism. Late last year, Google announced its intention to digitize millions of books from the collections of five major libraries in the U.S. and Britain. Last week, the Authors Guild announced its intention to sue the internet juggernaut for copyright infringement on a grand scale. The plaintiffs say Google must get permission of each and every copyright holder before scanning his or her books. Google maintains that because only small sections of the books will be put online, the so-called Google Print Library Project is actually good for authors in that it will massively increase the visibility of their books. Joining me now to parse the controversy is Siva Vaidyanathan, who teaches in the Culture and Communications Department at New York University. Siva, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob. It's good to be here.
Begin, please, by describing how the Google Print program would work as it's currently envisioned.
As you described, the Library Project is a massive endeavor done without the express permission of publishers or copyright holders. For public domain books, books published before 1923, books that are definitely beyond copyright, we are going to get full text capability. However, for most of the books published in the 20th century, we are only going to get snippets. We're only going to get a series of pages. You would not be able to read more than three or four at a time. You would not be able to print them out. It would give you a taste of the book. And on the left-hand side of the column, you would be given links for places you could buy the book, either online or in real life, and libraries in your area where the book would be available.
So it would seem to me like this would be a great deal for any author, certainly a way for lesser-known authors to have their books made more visible to the public, which might, you know, buy them with a mouse click or two.
I think it's impossible to predict any market effect one way or the other at this point. So I totally understand their anxiety and their motivation. What's interesting about their claim is they think that Google should go back and find the copyright holder in every case of this project and clear the rights. Well, that's frankly impossible. Our copyright system is so poorly laid out that you can't find who owns most books. There's no database. So most of the time, whether you're a historian trying to use photographs in a book or you're a publisher trying to republish a long-lost work, there's no way to clear the rights and things don't get done.
But in the absence of certainty about what kind of market effect it will have, the authors are saying the market is irrelevant. We own this work and we have the right to say how it's duplicated, period.
That's right. And that is the traditional understanding of how copyright works in the real world, in the book world. Now, you know, traditionally in copyright, there are limits to the power that a copyright holder has. And among those limits is fair use. Fair use is what secondary users can claim to be able to use elements of copyrighted works, or sometimes the entire copyrighted work under certain conditions. And fair use is there to encourage criticism, journalism, parody, scholarship and teaching, and other public goods. So fair use works in a certain way in the real world, in the analog world. It works sort of under different principles in the web world.
Well, I want to ask you about that, because obviously in this digital age, we can hyperlink entire pages of content without any kind of permission. Do the old notions of what constitutes fair use have to change in the digital world?
Well, they already have, for the basic reason that Google has based its entire business on the fact that it can copy almost the entire web without any serious copyright implications. Because to create an index, it has to make copies. If you don't want someone copying your work online, it's your duty to opt out of the system. There are ways that the New York Times makes sure that its news stories, for instance, don't get copied by Google and then placed in the index. Now, most people producing most web pages opt in or don't opt out. And Google has been free riding on all of this content around the web that people have been creating for more than a decade. What Google is now doing is reaching into the real world, into the analog world, into book world, and saying, all right, now you're going to play by our rules. What you're seeing here is the norms of the real world are clashing with the norms of the web world.
As you look at how courts have behaved on questions of fair use, you know, what would be your bet as to how this litigation may turn out?
Well, I'm not confident that Google's rather bold goals are going to satisfy the courts in this country. And if a court comes along and rules against Google in an indelicate way that goes beyond the particular contours of this case, it could rein in a lot of what Google wants to do in the future and maybe even what Google has done so far.
So if I understand this right, you're actually sympathetic with Google's view of how fair use and copyright law should be understood, but you just think that they're rolling the dice and too likely to hit snake eyes on this one.
Exactly. I see our copyright system right now as rather absurd and unworkable. And what does work is delicate. It's a delicate ecosystem. And I'm very worried about something so disruptive and so revolutionary, really flattening out a lot of the nuances of copyright that have allowed for such amazing creativity in the web world.
If not Google now, then who? And when? Who should be in charge of deciding which books get scanned?
Well, I actually think that this is the job of libraries. I think libraries should be doing this first and foremost. The Library of Congress should have identified this as a major public need and goal and pursued this sort of project years ago. Instead, they've outsourced it to a private corporation. And this corporation, as good as they like to make us think they are, is still operating by keeping us blind. Their technology is proprietary. Their algorithms for search are completely secret. We don't actually know what's going to generate a certain list of search results. They don't work for us.
You're suggesting this is a war that has to be fought. You just don't want Google to be the one doing the fighting.
Yeah, it's a sad commentary on our sort of state of information these days, that it takes a daring and, for now anyway, rich company to make these sort of inroads and stand up for a more flexible copyright system, when in fact our public institutions should be doing this. But in this day and age, it's not very fashionable to believe that public institutions can actually do anything for us.
Siva, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Siva Vaidyanathan is author of Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity.
And now for an important update. I was had. In our March 5th, 2004 show, I did an interview with Joseph Medawar and Allison Herruth Waterbury. The former was executive producer and the latter a producer and co-star of the upcoming TV show DHS The Series, supposedly a drama based on Daring Do inside the Department of Homeland Security. Here's an excerpt from that interview.
Before we saw the president, we had a very nice conversation with Karl Rove on where we are and how far we're going with it. When Mr. Tom Ridge came to Los Angeles to inspire the entertainment division of doing shows about the department, the head of our production had met with him. There was tremendous amount of enthusiasm and excitement. And if I may add something, it was very funny. Our head of production turned to Mr. Ridge and said, who would you like to see play your part? And Mr. Ridge kind of giggled and he said, hold off 2 years, maybe I'll come back and play it myself.
What we didn't know at the time was that Medawar, who you just heard in the tape, apparently was lying when he suggested the White House had endorsed the project. Based on that lie, he was able to defraud some 70 investors out of $5.5 million. Anyway, that's according to the U.S. attorney, who alleges that the accused spent the loot living the high life with no intention of ever producing the show. Last Friday, agents of the FBI and the IRS arrested Joseph Medawar. He faces up to 25 years in the clink if convicted.
We will, of course, continue to update you on all criminal investigations involving our former guests. Let us know if you hear of any by writing to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
Coming up, a look back to the 50s when newsman Edward R. Murrow took a side on a story because there's only one side to take.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, a new study offers a few surprises about how Americans use media. It comes from Ball State University's Center for Media Design, and it's called Middletown Media Studies 2. It builds on a smaller study from 2 years ago when the center sent researchers out to shadow residents of Muncie. Researchers literally spent all day in the homes and workplaces of their subjects, entering data every 15 seconds about whether and how the subject was interacting with media. In a world where most media research relies on self-reporting, this study stands alone and could yield the most accurate insights yet into our increasingly media-centric lives. Telecommunications professor Bob Papper co-authored the report. Bob, welcome back to OTM.
Thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate being here.
Let's start with what was surprising about your findings.
What we found is media use is clearly the number one activity that people engage with. Over two-thirds of the observed day, people were using at least one, if not more than one, media.
So people are consuming media more than they eat, than
yes.
they talk on the phone,
yes.
than everything.
Then they sleep. It is far and away the number one activity in people's lives.
People have spent a lot of time observing how the television is becoming less central to our lives and giving ground to the internet. Do the statistics that you've gathered support that analysis?
Not necessarily. Computer use has certainly gained. It's now number two overall in terms of how much time people spend with different media. But television has almost a 2-to-1 margin over computer use. Common sense may tell us that as new media comes along, it replaces old media. But what we find is that people are just piling media on top of each other. Over 30% of the time, people are using two or more media at the same time. And in time spent, one of the most common pairings is TV and the web.
Behavior according to age was actually one of the bigger surprises, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I would have guessed that the 18 to 24-year-olds would have been total internet junkies, but turns out that's not so.
It isn't so. The biggest computer users are clearly 25 to 64. Technically, only 65-plus use the computer less than 18 to 24-year-olds. It's work. That's what it's about. What we have is TV is easily the dominant medium at home. The radio is the dominant medium in the car. The computer is the dominant medium at work.
One of the more interesting findings involves the differences between men and women and how they use the computer.
Yes. Men and women are virtually identical users of the computer in terms of how much. It's that they do different things on the computer. Women are much more likely to be involved in surfing the web, and they're way more likely to be involved in email, whereas men are more likely to be involved in software use and much heavier users of instant messaging.
And, of course, because you did have researchers in the room with the subjects, you probably saw a bare minimum of internet porn downloading, which probably would have skewed your findings a little bit.
Bob, once again, we observed no use of pornography. And we, as always, of course, we attribute that to clean Midwestern living.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the explanation. So as you sit back and look at the data overall, are there any clear conclusions that you can draw from them that tell us something about our society and in what direction it is headed?
It looks like people are just going to be using more and more media. And I've been asked, well, you know, what's the limit? Well, you know, it's kind of like hours of the day. You used to say there's 24, but if you're going to use two or more media at the same time, you can really stretch that out.
5,000 hours.
Yes.
394 study subjects.
Mm-hmm.
At any point, was any of those 394 people listening to On the Media?
You're going to have to give me probably a few months, and we'll know the answer to that. But I have no doubt that they certainly should be listening to On the Media.
All right. That's pretty much the answer I was looking for.
Okay.
Bob, once again, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Bob.
Bob Papper is professor of telecommunications at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana, and co-author of Middletown Media Studies 2.
And another study caught our attention this week, the annual Gallup poll, which found that half of all Americans have a great deal or a fair amount of confidence in the news media. That's higher than last year, but still far lower than in previous years. In times of national stress, Americans renew the old and durable debate over how far the press ought to go in telling truth to power. We've been passing through one of those times, and another such time occurred during the early days of network TV, the era of Senator Joseph McCarthy and newsman Edward R. Murrow, who waged an epic battle on the small screen.
Our working thesis tonight is this quotation: if this fight against communism is made a fight between America's two great political parties, the American people know that one of these parties will be destroyed, and the Republic cannot endure very long as a one-party system. We applaud that statement, and we think Senator McCarthy ought to. He said it 17 months ago in Milwaukee.
That was Murrow throwing down the gauntlet in 1954 on his program See It Now. It was an act of considerable coverage depicted powerfully in the new film Good Night and Good Luck, co-written and directed by George Clooney and starring David Strathairn as Murrow. Good Night and Good Luck refers to Murrow's famous sign-off, but in the context of the film, it could also be heard as Murrow's last lingering hope for the future of the nation and for his network, CBS. Among the crusading journalists who then worked at CBS were a group referred to as Murrow's Boys, among them reporter Joe Wirshbaugh, played by Robert Downey in the film. Patricia Clarkson plays his wife Shirley, another CBS producer. The real-life couple consulted on the new film, and they join us now from their home on Long Island. Joe, Shirley, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So this is one evocative film. It's shot in black and white. And, of course, in early 1954, McCarthy's hearings of accused subversives were broadcast. They were the first ever televised hearings, and they were used in the film. So McCarthy essentially plays himself. Murrow, of course, couldn't be depicted by recycling old TV footage, so they have an actor to play him. You knew Murrow. How accurately do you think he was depicted in the film?
If you closed your eyes during the first read-through of the script, I did close my eyes, and I thought I was hearing Murrow.
We must not confuse dissent with disloyalty. We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law.
It was unbelievable.
I'll tell you how unbelievable it was. When I first saw Strathairn, I saw him from the back of his head. And I said, my God, it's Murrow's head. And the minute he opened his mouth and looked towards us, it was Murrow all over again. He didn't try to imitate Murrow. He exuded Murrow.
George Clooney plays the legendary Fred Friendly as a relatively quiet, wry person. He was Murrow's producer. He also functioned in some degree, it seems, as his heat shield.
Fred Friendly was the enforcer. Murrow came up with what he wanted to do with the line that he was taking, and Fred saw to it that all the stuff that we had was edited with that in mind. If anybody ever terrorized people, it was Fred.
I think he wanted Murrow to have all of the attention.
One thing I noticed was that during Murrow's broadcasts, we see Fred Friendly literally crouched at his feet, obscured partly by his desk, and he cued Murrow by tapping a pen on Murrow's knee. And he lit Murrow's cigarettes during the taped segments, speaking quietly, still crouched there. Was that what it was really like?
Yes, exactly. That was the way he cued Murrow to start, because they were in very, very tight quarters. As a matter of fact, some of the people who saw a screening of it, people like Tom Brokaw and Dan Rather and Morley Safer and Walter Cronkite, they said they have never seen a newsroom film that was as authentic as this.
Cigarette smoke seems to fill nearly every frame, mostly coming from Murrow's cigarette.
Everybody smoked in those days. I smoked. Joe smoked.
At a time when we went to Korea to cover the Korean War in 52, Ed and I shared a room, and at 4:30 in the morning I would hear a zip, and that was Murrow starting his morning with a cigarette. He was doing a minimum of 2 packs a day, but I think he went up to 4 packs a day.
Yeah, he always had a cigarette.
And he just couldn't be talked out of it until he developed lung disease later on.
And he died of lung cancer in 1964.
Yes, he did. The interesting thing about the crew of actors in the scene is that I don't think any of them smoke. And here they had to. But I know they were not inhaling. They were just puffing it out. And when George Clooney learned from Ruth Friendly that Fred Friendly had never smoked, he was so relieved because he's not a smoker. He didn't have to smoke, but everybody else did.
I want to move to the political environment now, and I'm talking about politics with a big P and politics with a small P. In terms of office politics, there was a rule that professional colleagues at CBS weren't allowed to marry.
You weren't allowed to be in the company if you had a relative there, whether it was a cousin, an uncle, a sister, and certainly you couldn't be married.
Well, what's a fancy word for that kind of a situation?
Nepotism.
Well, that was supposed to be nepotism at $45 a week, and that was a big word to spread over $45.
We knew that one of us would have to quit. As a matter of fact, the boss at the time said he thought that we ought to get married, and I said, well, we would, except I don't want to quit working. So he said, well, don't tell anybody about it. I'll try to clear it with personnel, which he never did, so we had to keep it a secret.
So did you really take off your wedding rings before you went to work?
Absolutely. Joe actually didn't wear one. But I put it on a gold chain around my neck. I always had high neck blouses.
Let me move on to William Paley. He ran the CBS network for what, about 50 years?
Well, he started it.
He's depicted by Frank Langella as a figure who is as huge and immovable as the Washington Monument. What role did he play in the real-life drama?
Bill Paley created the Columbia Broadcasting System. He backed the best news and news people that he could find. Murrow was his boy.
And his friend.
And his friend. It was a rarity for anybody to be Bill Paley's friend who wasn't a member of the family.
Okay, but we see in the film a rather testy exchange between Murrow and Paley.
It got to that stage only because Murrow and Friendly were not going to quit cold on the stories that they did. Paley knew that they weren't going to quit, and I thought that it was a fair shake that somebody should know that going on the air with an attack on McCarthy, this was breaking the rule which Paley and Murrow themselves had set up, which could lead to closing down the whole news business.
Somebody's going to go down. Have you checked your facts? Are you sure you're on safe ground?
Bill, it's time. Show our cards.
My cards. You lose, what happens? Five guys find themselves out of work. I'm responsible for a hell of a lot more than five goddamn reporters. Let it go.
You could tell that a lot of the people were worried stiff about what the consequences of this program would be, and Murrow caught that and said, "Terra is right here in this room." And then he followed up with another line, which unfortunately is not in the script, but I remember it, and couldn't have made it up myself. "No one man can terrorize a whole nation unless we are all his accomplices."
You know, in the end, it wasn't politics, but bottom line pressures that compelled Paley to act and essentially push Murrow off of his primetime perch.
Well, you know, Paley, I think he once said his sorriest day was when he went public with the company, because then he had to answer to the economic pressures that would come from shareholders. You had to turn a profit. I think Paley, given his druthers, would have gone along with Murrow all the way.
You know, you two have in the film an exchange in bed one night. Mm. It's of such critical dramatic significance, I kind of thought it was added by the writers. Joe, you sort of muse, what if we meaning Murrow's boys, are wrong? What if there are communists out there poised to take down our government? And you said, what if we're protecting the wrong people? Did that exchange happen?
Not really. We talked about not so much were we wrong, but were we doing the right thing? Because we grew up in this atmosphere of you don't take sides. You just present the news straight. That was the discussion that Joe and I used to have. Should we break with it? And I can remember that thought in particular. You've got to do it. You've got to go with this program, or else what happens to the country? Also, he did offer McCarthy equal time to answer.
Some say that the wise, deadpan news anchor of old is passing out of time. Some of them see this as the model of the Murrow tradition, but actually, if you look at the film, Murrow wasn't the very model of the objective, opinion-free anchor. His legend is built on when he took a stand. Nowadays, that would be seen as questionable journalism, and I don't think he'd last long in the anchor chair.
Well, he wouldn't be doing it every night or every week. It was on very, very special occasions. If you recall, Walter Cronkite stepped out behind that wall of impartiality when he said the Vietnam War was unwinnable. On rare occasions, if someone you respect who has been impartial, if he or she should say, "There is only one side here. I will give it to you." And then it's up to your audience to make the decision.
I must tell you that Murrow agonized over what right did he have to use the whole power of a network to go against one man. And the answer to that is that man, is strong enough to take care of himself. And that's where that line from Shakespeare comes in.
Earlier, the senator asked, "Upon what meat does this our Caesar feed?" Had he looked three lines earlier in Shakespeare's Caesar, he would have found this line, which is not altogether inappropriate. "The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves." No one familiar with the history of this country can deny that congressional committees are useful. It is necessary to investigate before legislating, but the line between investigating and persecuting is a very fine one, and the junior senator from Wisconsin has stepped over it repeatedly.
Right after he came out of the studio, having done the McCarthy broadcast, I knew I was going to be having children, and I said, Ed, if it's a boy, I'm going to name him after you. And he answered, do you think it was worth it? And I said, it has to be.
Did you name your child after him?
I did.
So you guys didn't take your work home.
We lived our work.
Between them, Joe and Shirley Wershbaugh have spent many decades toiling in network news. We reach them at their home on Long Island.
Whatever happens in this whole area of the relationship between the individual and the state, we will do it ourselves. It cannot be blamed on Malenkov or Mao Zedong or even our allies. And it seems to us, that is, Fred Friendly and myself, that this is a subject that should be argued about endlessly. Good night and good luck.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff, Sarah Dalsimer, Derek John, and David Ocasio. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy. And the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. Support for On the Media comes from the Lincoln Center, presenting Lang Lang, performing Chopin's first piano concerto with the New York Philharmonic under music director Lauren Mazel, on Live from Lincoln Center, sponsored by MetLife, airing September 22nd on PBS, and the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.